to a new edition of the Manat Digital Podcast. I'm thrilled to be here with Chris Denson, author, Crushing the Box, 10 Essential Rules for Breaking Essential Rules, creator and host of the Innovation Crush Podcast, and longtime executive working in Los Angeles in and around innovation and with companies. Chris, great to have you here.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that warm round of applause.
And here with us also
from myself
is my colleague Skip Garrett, senior analyst at Manat Digital, and he'll be joining in on the podcast as well. Welcome, Skip.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. I mean, I think that might be a good place to start. You have a fantastically interesting career path. You're working in the heart of innovation in media. How do you describe yourself?
I guess a phrase that comes to mind is culturally curious. You know, I'm curious as to how things work in culture, why they work, you know, and I guess a competitive spirit of how do we make it better or how do I make it better than they made it. And so that for me just comes to this idea of innovation, like how can we reimagine moments and products that people engage with.
And when you use the word innovation, what do you mean by that?
Such an empty word, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. but so many people use it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's really kind of a catchphrase today.
It sounds cool, and then you're like, well, what is it? And then that's the hard part.
I'm the new director of innovation. I'm the chief innovation officer, right?
There's a word for that. It's called like a lead or something, like where you have like a really, really weird title on your business card, and so it sparks conversation. Because innovation is sort of malleable in that sense, depending on where, you know, it shows up. But essentially, for me, it literally is that idea of reimagining something. You know, it may be iterative where there's an improvement, but, you know, I think in its truest sense, it's a game-changing, you know, creative application of business and ideas. So I never say it's synonymous with technology. I think that's usually people's first go-to. But when you look at sort of analog culture, you know, a few years ago, I was really obsessed with like Daybreaker dance parties. And you're like, wow, so these people get up and go party and rave at 6 o'clock in the morning all over the world. Not just, you know, oh, this thing happened on Tuesday. It's like if you go to Daybreaker, you know, it was a website, and they started a movement of drug-free raves. It's the new exercise for millennials and Gen Z or whoever chooses to go. So just, you know, innovation is that sort of like, I didn't know that was a movement, let alone, you know, create something that applies to it well.
Yeah. That's a good example of an innovation partying all over the world. A clean, sounds like safe way to do it. What are some other innovations you've seen in your time? And I would even go so far as to ask, what's the most disruptive innovation you've seen?
Man, I think, you know, when I look at that over the course of a period of time, let's call it 3 to 5 years, it's the compounded innovations that work. There was a period of time when there's a guy named Rashad Tabakawala, and he kind of, I think he was the first to kind of make this connection. But the same year the iPhone was introduced was also the same year Facebook no longer required a .edu. Mm. And, you know, those two things, if you look at the FANG acronym, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google, it's like those are the compounded access to things, you know. So when you look at most recently, to answer your question more practically, I think a lot about augmented reality and the implications of that, and not even just looking at something through your device and getting another visual overlay, but an augmented experience, something that's secondary to whatever it is you're doing. In some cases, it's audio, where things can translate languages in real time. And so you and I can have a conversation. You're speaking French, I'm speaking Swahili. And, you know, suddenly we can have a real-time dialogue without a translator or without, like, Google Translate or whatever. So it's these compounded technologies that I'm sort of obsessed with when things start to marry. And you're like, oh, now it's about to be crazy. Yeah. So
You mentioned earlier that innovation doesn't necessarily have to include technology, But it seems like these days so much of what we talk about, particularly here in Hollywood, is around, and in media, is around technology and the disruptive impact. And mm-hmm. everyone's looking for kind of the next big thing.
Right.
What is kind of the unique role that technology plays in innovation? And how do we kind of, you know, as media executives know where to focus our efforts when it comes to technology?
I think it's going to be a return to my previous answer, mm-hmm. which is kind of like, forget the tech for a second, mm-hmm. right? What is the emotional connection you want to create with that consumer, that customer, that client? You know, write a story, you know, write a couple of paragraphs of a day in the life of that person that you're trying to reach, that archetype. You know, if when I was at Machinima, for instance, we focused on that fanboy, or I interviewed the resident disruptor of Taco Bell, and he said, we focus on a 20-year-old male, right? And that is our only customer. And so whatever else they begin to create, whether it's the Frito taco shells, or it's their app that will order your food for you before you even set foot in the Taco Bell, kind of like preemptively, it answers the question from a business standpoint of how do we engage and serve our clients and customers better. Because to your point, there's hundreds of, you know, of thousands of different applications of technology that you can dizzy yourself all day. It's like, oh, well, what should we do on Snapchat? And like, maybe Snapchat isn't your thing, right? Like, you don't be, or if you are there, you can't just do what every other brand.
Do you have to be everywhere? I mean, and that's kind of, I guess, to your point too, is you know, if storytelling is at the heart of it, and storytelling maybe a different tact on different mediums, right. You can't be everywhere, or can you?
You can, but should you, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's mm-hmm. where can you, if you're talking about, like, let's call it social platforms for a second, mm-hmm. Where have you developed and nurtured your audience? Like, for instance, mm-hmm. the majority of the following on my show, probably 2/3 of them, are on SoundCloud. Is it the most, you know, robust platform? Not necessarily. Is mm-hmm. it the one that everyone goes to? No, but like somehow that's where I built the majority of my audience. So I primarily focus there. And so, you know, and then of course we're on iTunes and Spotify and, you know, all the other platforms. But no matter how big your team is, you're not going to be a master of all these things. So it's just carefully crafting like whatever your strategy is, and then looking at like back-end tools that may, and from a social perspective, allow you to publish once, publish everywhere, right? So I use a back-end tool for my show that's the only real thing I'm like hands-on clicking around, you know, messing with, because once it goes to those other platforms, including my own website, it allows my job to be easier. And I think at its core, from a little bit more of a tactical standpoint, it should make your life easier. It should make your customers' life easier. I think about other brands that participate in social media. You know, KFC is a great one. And they follow the Spice Girls, and I think, I forget the exact number, but 5 guys named Herb. So the joke is that it's 11 herbs and spices. So they only have 11, you know, people that they follow on social media. And they find a way to be kitschy and playful, and Twitter works well for them to do that. And so, again, it's like, who are you trying to serve? What's your brand spirit? You know, is it playful? Is it visual? Is it informative? And which platform serves as the best platform to deliver the experience you want to create?
We talked about platforms, we talked about storytelling, we talked about innovation. Right now in the media world, we see a lot of M&A, a lot of the traditional studios trying to keep up with Fang as they come into the content space, spending billions of dollars. What's your take on that? And what do you think is gonna happen over the next 3 to 5 years as more money starts to come in from the tech players for storytelling?
It's a tough racket. That's always a hard question, because I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, now such and such is going to go, cable's going away. Like, I, you know, for years you've heard XYZ is movie theaters are going to close. I mean, you know, the only thing that's suffering the most, I would say, is like retail. But from a content space, I mean physical retail, but from a content space, I think people gravitate toward, good storytelling. Again, from our caveman days, gathering around a campfire, and there's drawings on the wall because they're telling a story. And the better the story, the better the experience. What I hope will happen is that, someone or one of those entities will have a platform that invites all the other players to be there. When the Xbox One launched, right, they had a thing where if I wanted to search for a title, it would show me that specific title and show me the three or four different platforms it shows up on. Do you want to watch it on Amazon? Do you want to watch it on Netflix? Or do you want to watch it live on Tuesday? Right. It's and so that's if you again you start to think about the pain points of viewership. I know I spend a good 30, 45 minutes flipping around through Netflix before I even choose something. And I almost have FOMO because I don't know what else I've, I'm missing out on.
It does seem like the discovery is still a big issue to be cracked for these services. Right?
Yes.
I do the same thing, still flipping all around. Last night, just as example, I wanted to watch the new Goliath, and I thought, was that on Netflix or Amazon?
Yeah, exactly.
So first I was on Netflix and flipping around. Oh, I guess it was Amazon, right?
They're like, I'm going to bed. Like that's kind of, there's a couple of shows I will latch on to, but I think the same thing, when I use that example of like who will create that envelope and kind of super serve all those customers where my interface shows me the best content on each platform or wherever I want to see it. One of my favorite examples of that is Under Armour. Under Armour a few years ago was like, we don't care if you have a Fitbit or a Misfit or, a Jawbone or whatever, like you can use your wearable technology on our platform, right? So, and Under Armour, like they, of course they sell merchandise, they're selling, healthy living. But if they tried to create, their own wearable, or now they've got a compounded problem, right? Of discovery in that instance and competition. So whoever can create the Switzerland for any of these things, really, like we were just joking earlier about Lime and Bird, what if there was one app to rule them all? So now I can whichever one is closest to me, I can grab. But I haven't seen a lot of those kinds of solutions.
Taking kind of a step back to brands, because I know you've worked with a lot of the biggest brands in the world at Omnicom and in other agencies where you've worked. What do you think? I mean, it seems like the line between the brand as a content experience creator and content studios, television. Film creators is blurring a bit. What's going on around content marketing and that intersection with entertainment?
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is again sort of that compounded, kind of methodology of creating experiences. I look at everything as a brand experience, whether I saw a billboard or I walked into your store or I went to a pop-up or I found you on social media. It's like I experience you at multiple touch points. Mm. And so if I can create content that serves multiple purposes, whether it's a bad example is if you have a conference and you shoot the content there, but you're also, allowing people to socially engage in real time with the speaker. So it's just like using all those different tools. And then you've got some VOD content that comes away from that. Another great example is Can hired me a few weeks ago to host their first live television broadcast. So they had 50 hours of live programming. There were three of us who were hosts, two in studio, and then me sort of running all around. So part of it was me just being in the face and going backstage and seeing things, and then bringing that to the studio and then going into the studio and talking about it. So there was a, I'll call it a brick and mortar manifestation of, hey, we have a television, why are you here with this camera and a microphone? Has their first ever television. Oh, where can I find it? Right, it becomes these multiple touch points, all under this guise of, in this case, like innovation and connection and discovery. So you have to look at a few, what are the key goals you want to accomplish, and not only that, how can you double up where it's appropriate?
We talk. There's a lot of talk about how millennials are spending over 70% of their consumptions on experiences as opposed to products. Does every brand need to think of themselves as an experience creator today?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because it was a few years ago. It was like every company is a tech company, is, you know.
Right.
So, and similarly, I think more so than marketing, I think it's meaning. You know, how can I actually make a point to super serve you at a time of need? You know, I think if, let's say, Intel is going to do something at Coachella, is, yeah, you can go, like, we went to the Intel house. That was cool. But what's the pain point that everybody at Coachella has? You know, I don't know, is it thirst deprivation or, you know, rehab or whatever it is? But, you know, does Intel set up a rehab center, you know, a 24-hour rehab at Coachella? So, you know, the pop-up becomes something that actually serves the people who are there, as opposed to, like, come look at us and push these buttons, which are what most of these experiences are. So, again, I had a conversation with a trade show recently, and they were like, we had a merch booth, but nobody purchased anything. And I was like, well, I know when I go to, like, conferences and events, I hate to carry stuff around. Right. So why not partner with Ship, you know, or, you know, some other, or Amazon Locker, so that serve me, that I will buy the t-shirt and the, you know, and the tchotchkes, as long as I can put them somewhere until I'm ready to leave. Or better yet, send it to me so that when I get home, it's there. And, you know, I think if you think through a partnership like that, maybe there's a reduced fee for those attendees and Ship pays us. Like, there's a number of different ways to sort of iron it out. But again, it's a brick and mortar experience. And then, you know, suddenly you're figuring out what the pain points are for that individual.
Another thing brands are seeming to struggle with is how to reach millennials. We are always on our phones. You know, the younger generation playing Fortnite or on Snapchat constantly, mm-hmm. not really looking up and looking at the TV and watching ads, maybe not even watching ads as they roll on YouTube, maybe just skipping over those. How can brands effectively reach this millennial demographic, which is a highly valuable demographic?
If I had to answer that question, I wouldn't be here. I'd be like, see you later, schmoes, I'm rich.
Or kick around some ideas or some thoughts or
maybe 2 years you can catch me. My calendar is full of money. No, I think it just goes, I mean, there's some science to it. You know, what did they buy and when did they buy it, mm-hmm. right? And so just looking at, there's enough, even just from, you mentioned two amazing, you know, mobile platforms. Mm-hmm. There's enough data out there. Foursquare, for instance, has a tremendous amount of data to this day. They're not the same social platform they used to be, but they've shifted to become just a mobile data platform. So they can pinpoint a target demographic geographically or, you know, globally and say, this is the behavior that we see. And I think then you're able to look at what those pain points are. I mean, and then, you know, like, I think there's some common sense to it as well. When you were 16, 17, 22, like, you know, what were you doing? What brand loyalty did you really have, right? It was music, it was maybe some cool clothes, and then you ate Cheetos. Like, it was you were not trying to buy health insurance, right?
I feel like that has really changed, though. Maybe I'm off, but my generation, and I'm dating myself a bit, but I'm not a millennial, and, you know, we were almost anti-brand.
How was that first car ride, you know, by the way?
it was almost a, you know, and particularly when it came to music. I mean, you might remember these days of, you know, there was a real volatile feeling towards brands being associated with concerts and bands, you mm-hmm. know, for many years. It was almost like it took the purity out of the music,
right.
You know. Today, you know, it's just flipped on its head.
I still think it's the same thing, right? Like, I think mm-hmm. even in your example, mm-hmm. this brand brought me a special experience, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same thing, but what is that experience? Is it an exclusive behind-the-scenes look at the creation of Linkin Park's new album, you know, not that Gen Z listens to Linkin Park, yeah. But, you know, so what sort of gift or experience can I still give to that consumer, knowing how, because the I think one of the big differences is love, the degree of transparency we have and the degree of access we have to the people thing and things we like. So yes, it makes it harder to create something special, but I think that's where sort of the mechanics of innovation comes in, as from a problem solving standpoint. You go like, all right, well, what can we do for these individuals that's special? Even in that merch conversation, I was like, well, is this merch that they can go and get anywhere? Or is it something that was specifically created for this thing? And they were like, oh, it's I could have got it, you know, Tuesday when I got home, right? So yeah, there was nothing that was special about it, and I have to carry it around. It's it's a double whammy. Yeah. I mean, a whammy is a good thing, right?
Yeah, the double part is even better. So you're an author too.
Yes.
And tell us about the book. What inspired you to write Crushing the Box? 10 Essential Rules.
I got my copy too. Thank you.
For breaking essential rules.
Thank you. Thank you for having your copy.
Having
a lot of conversations about just where does the best innovation come from. And I think in many cases, innovation aside, it's either we overcomplicate things or oversimplify them. So, it's like, all you got to do is set up a Twitter account. You're like, it's a little bit more scientific than that. Well, if we set up a Twitter account, who's going to manage it? And like, well, then how often should we post? That's too complicated. So I've had enough of those conversations, and also just through Innovation Crush, chatting with 200 of, and counting of some of the smartest people in the world, and then working with Fortune 50 brands and startups and other entities, I started to see some patterns and some missing links that aren't part of the current how-to discussion or the DIY discussions. For instance, we hear so much about fail hard and fail fast, and of course, if you're not failing, you're not doing it right.
There's a sign on the wall of my kid's elementary school that I see every day that don't be afraid to fail. It's right there in the elementary school.
Yes.
This is being taught at the youngest ages now.
Don't be afraid of it, mm-hmm. but don't seek it.
To your point, it's.
And I think that's where that's where I think the message gets lost. Is like, all right, let's try to break this thing. And it's and granted, there's some validity to that. I'm not like dismissing that entirely, but I felt like there was enough conversation out there with that. I wrote a chapter, on the concept of micro failures. It's not the big, now we have to close our company's doors and, how am I going to feed my family? It's, that investor that didn't return those 10 emails after you had the best meeting you've ever had in your life. And they're like, yeah, well, Tuesday, we'll be ready to go. And then it's a month later, 2 months later, and now your kid is in school and is failing with their grades, right? And there's these things that just scratch away at your creative spirit. You might be going through a divorce. And that, on Innovation Crush, there's a whole human side to this innovation story, right? Mm-hmm. People who go through life circumstances while they're building the thing that they're building, or they pause on it because something happened, or so how do you maintain that spirit of freedom and creativity? For some, like, the creation is just is the escape. For others, it's like everything else becomes a distraction for whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. So it was things like that where I was like, no one's paying attention to that. Or working with a Nike competitor who may be, 10th in the sports category. We don't have Nike money. We can't do that. And it's like, yes, you can, but you're thinking about it. You're going about it wrong. So that was sort of the impetus or the foundational development for the book.
Are the principles in the book timeless, do you think? You think you'll have to go back and do
it? I hope so. I need to sell some. I think so. I mean, I kind of, after I wrote it, where I kind of realized this, but it's like, 50% business mechanics and the other 50% is damn near personal development. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about like emotional intelligence, understanding that, sure, you may have the best product that since sliced bread, but at the end of the day, I have to go communicate that concept with a human being, or whether I want them to be a partner, an investor, a customer. I have to translate whatever this thing does into something that somebody's like, I want that. I want to be a part of that. So, and I think that's what we forget. And then, kind of to your point earlier, is, yes, there's tech everywhere. There's all these things. We're a very self-celebrating, community of creatives, especially like coastally. Mm-hmm. For instance, VR, my running joke was like, there are more VR companies making VR than there are people actually doing VR. And it's like, we have VR, we just launched a VR division. It's like, but then and it's all sort of entertainment and filmmaking, but then when you really sit back and look at where the numbers are coming from, even in holograms, for instance, right? Like, we heard all the Tupac stories and that kind of thing. But the biggest growth in the hologram industry is in medical practice. You know, visualizing organs and systems, and not just any, but yours, right? Like, here's your pancreas, and I can rotate it and show it to you, and this is what we're going to do. And if I'm a medical student, what, you know, it's a far better way to learn, too. So it's really just like taking a step back and taking a wide-eyed look at, you know, where the numbers actually are.
I've been studying a little bit about creativity, and one of the things that struck me is that there's been some, in more recent years, the line of thought is that anyone can be creative, and that it's not something that you're born with, and you know, for a long time people kind of thought this is something that you're either born creative, mm-hmm. and people talk about, oh, she's a creative kid,
right.
He's not, you know. Mm-hmm. But in fact, that's not the thinking today. I'm curious, kind of in your world, what kind of techniques do you use to spark creativity, personally and in group environments when you're working on projects?
I guess the first thing that comes to mind, I think in that instance where like, oh, it's not for me, I'm not a, sometimes those people need a safe invitation to do it, mm-hmm. right? If especially in a workplace, yeah. like that's a big risk. If I look foolish in front of my boss and my colleagues because this idea is not as well thought out, and like that's my hesitation, so I don't even say the thing, whatever it's supposed to, whatever the thought is. And so, you know, we talk a lot about brainstorming in the book, and how do you create an environment where people can say the dumb thing that's in the back of their head, and it doesn't have to be the answer. It doesn't have to be like, okay, we're going to do this, that, and the third, you know, and then, you know, we'll get 75 people to do this. It's just like, what about augmented mirrors? Like, that's a contribution to a brainstorm. You're like, oh, yeah, I did. And then you'll say, oh, I read about something. And it just starts this, you know, all you have to do is knock down one of the dominoes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to be the person with the answers. Mm-hmm. But most people don't feel safe in those environments. And like my recent sort of anecdote is like the brainstorm space should be like safer than HR, right?
Yeah. yeah.
You know, and HR is a... this person said blah, blah, blah to me. But this is a place where no matter what you say or saw, and then there's exercises that you can do to kind of get the jitters out. You know, we talk about these speed rounds where, you know, for the first 5 minutes, we're going to write down the worst idea possible. You just do a sprint. Fill up your paper with horrible ideas.
The bad ideas.
Right, exactly. And then you go around and you read them, right? You read them out loud, you know, pick three or whatever, or read them all. Yeah. And then the next part of that assignment becomes, all right, pick one and actually turn it into an awesome idea. Right, and maybe you pass that paper to the left, and now you're the person that's going to be working on my bad idea to make it cool. And so now suddenly I'm like, all right, I got in my like shaking the sillies out, as I say to my 5-year-old.
I like that. That's right. Creates that environment where you're not afraid to fail.
So right.
I like that.
Yeah.
One thing we're working on here at Manat Digital is experiential entertainment. Mm-hmm. We know that there's a huge opportunity for brands, companies. To establish some revenues, mm-hmm. to optimize some monetization there, and we want to help companies do that. What have you seen as far as experiential entertainment goes? I know we talked about a little bit of it in the beginning with brands, but experiential entertainment, everything from theme parks to festivals to mm-hmm. concerts, pop-ups, what do you see going on in that industry?
I nerded out a few months ago, shout out to a company called GMR. They did a study on the psychology of experiential, marketing tactics, and it talked about the why people go to certain things. Right? I may go to one thing because I want to escape. Like this is like your museums of ice cream. Mm-hmm. There's no educational value there. It's just like I'm escaping. I'm going to this whole other world. There's other things like the It House that Warner Brothers did, and that was. I'm going to go and be scared. There's other things where you go to learn. You know, you may go to a museum, or like we did an augmented vehicle for the Getty in LA, which is like a art installation. 80 institutions participated in it. but we created an experience because most people want to learn another thing about that art or that artist or what is this or who created it and why. So we created an experience where through augmented reality, they could get more information about that particular piece. But like we made it really fun and engaging. So there's these different psychological values that people get from engaging in an experience. And so you design for that. And yeah, I think it's right. I think they're, you know, the flip side of that is we do want to put our phones down, right? We don't know how, and to the point where Apple is like, you know what? Now we have some tools by which you can actually monitor your, I have an app on my phone called Moment, mm-hmm. and it tells me how much time I've spent on my phone, whether it went down or up yep. from the previous day. And then they, after, you know, a while of you having this thing on, it starts to give you personal sort of advice on how to do it. So, you know, just understanding that, you know, not everything has to be in an experiential environment, has to be like Instagrammable or something. Like I have to have sure. my phone out. Matter of fact, that some of the best ones I've gone to are like, please put your phone away yeah. for this. And you're like, oh, like, so you're fully mm-hmm. present. Yeah. And people are shocked at like feeling. You're tapping on glass all day.
Something else I was reading about at least recently is boredom and kind of the role that boredom can play in creativity. And you know, as a kid without phones mm-hmm. and computers, I remember, you know, summers we'd often just be. We'd go outside at 8 in the morning, we'd come back at 5 at night, we'd figure out what to do, mm-hmm. right? And kind of what that breeded in terms of creative thought. And today we're just so overstimulated.
Right.
You know, there's hardly time to think of something new.
And you have access to everything. That, you know, that's the other part of it. It's like, I want to hear that song, I'll just pull it up. I have a 13-year-old daughter, and she went to go visit my mom in Michigan. And so she called me. She does not have a phone, but she, you know, but she called me and was like, "Oh, I found your box of cassette tapes." And so she was like, she was picking them up and like going through them, yeah, and like, yeah. she, and then she, one of them, she was like, "Who's $2 short?" And I was like, "You mean too short?" I was like, "You don't need to listen to that." But and then as we were talking, I was like, "I have three like gigantic boxes filled with CDs," and there was something about like collecting music, looking at the art, and so on and so forth. And so, how do you create that same, you know, not the same experience, but the same sort of level of engagement
and curiosity? And if you use the word curiosity,
yes, exactly. Yep. And so, it's a challenge. I don't know what the answer is, but. But there is an answer, I think, and it's going to be different for each brand that needs to engage and create memories.
So what's next for you, Chris? What's on the horizon? What new innovations are you leading? How are you making your mark on the industry going forward?
I'm the guy who wants to help turn the switch on. I believe that you can't unknow something. So I think, you know, with my team when I was at OMD, one of the big hangups was that, you know, for every case study I can tell you, there's probably 50 to 75 projects that are dead in the water at various stages. You know, some like day before launch, you're like, nah, we're not gonna do this. Some are like, no, but this is a great idea. No, next, let's go to the next page. You're like, no, I'm telling you. So, and I think people like the team would be like kind of disheartened because we didn't get to make the thing. Right, and I was like, that's not always the end game. The end game sometimes is being in the room, and you know, we say one of the biggest compliments we could get is like, I didn't know that was possible. I didn't know there was a robot that, you know, could read my messages to me and, you know, send me pictures of my mom who's, you know, mm-hmm. should be taking her medicine and give her reminders. Okay. And so once you have certain concepts or constructs into your brain, they stay with you. So, and I go, even if it's something like very tactical, like the bad robot example I just gave. Shout out to J.J. Abrams. It was weird. Bad robot. So anyway, it's that person may go home and tell their spouse. Their spouse may tell another coworker. And that coworker tells their spouse. And then it gets done over there, right? There's this invisible effect of just presenting great thinking to people, and I found that that's sort of my role in the industry, and of course on occasion I do it alongside them, so helping come up with, you know, innovative solutions or introducing them to resources and collaborators depending on what it is they want to accomplish. And again, just through Innovation Crush and through the work I've done with OMD. And prior to that, I just like built up a decent enough Rolodex that if I go like, hey, what if we did this? And they're like, okay, I think I know who I might be able to call to either ask my dumb questions or like bring them into a room for a conversation. I have no hard skills. I can't code. I can't pick up a camera. I can't. So it's like, my superpower is, you know, resource and like just creative translation, I guess.
Fantastic. I think that's a wrap. Yeah. Chris, thanks for coming and sharing your curiosity and insight with us.
Thank you.
Wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Awesome.